The House Health and Human Service Reform Committee will come to order. Representative Tice moves the minutes for March 22, 2018. Are there any additions, corrections, or changes to be made to the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption of the minutes for March 22, 2018, signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails and the minutes are adopted for March 22, 2018. First up on the agenda this morning is House File 3822, Representative Albright. Representative Albright moves House File 3822 be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law and Data Practices Policy. Representative Albright, we have the bill in front of us. To your bill.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. House File 3822 is a technical bill that makes changes to the Board of Behavioral Health and Therapy. I have two testifiers with me this morning that can explain the technical nature of the changes to the statute.
All right, welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Walter Roberts, Jr., and I serve as the chair of the Board of Behavioral Health and Therapy. Today with me is our executive director, Carrie Rexigal. The board was created in 2003 and today licenses over 5,000 individuals as alcohol and drug counselors, professional counselors, and professional clinical counselors. Our licensees work with individuals who experience a wide variety of mental health and chemical concerns. Since its inception, the board has made specific efforts to be responsive to the needs of our citizens, particularly in rural Minnesota, and to facilitate the licensure of individuals who are appropriately qualified. To that end, you have before you today a bill that will in part continue that mission. The handout that you have in your packet summarizes the main points of House File 3822. Sections 1 and 3 of the bill will provide authorization to the board to more quickly license individuals from other states with similar qualifications who have had no record of discipline against their existing license. This proposal fits within the nationwide effort among mental health professions to expand portability and make it easier for duly qualified licensees to practice across state lines. Portability is the future of licensure, and we would like to go ahead and implement it with our licensees in an effort to open the doors of practice for those who may be so inclined to provide their services in Minnesota. Section 2 of House File 3822 is the technical change. In 2016, all other identified providers of psychotherapeutic services by the state had the duty to warn language added to their practice in response to a court decision which revealed that interns and those in supervised post-degree practice were not allowed by state statute to breach confidence in instances of potential harm to the client or directed toward others. Licensed professional counselors and licensed professional clinical counselors were not included in that change, but should have been. It was a simple oversight. Section 2 of this bill corrects that oversight and once again extends greater protection to the public. Again, we thank you for this opportunity to testify on behalf of the bill. We particularly thank Representative Albright for his sponsorship. Ms. Rexigal and I will answer any questions that you have at this point.
All right. Are there any questions for the testifier? Representative Liebling.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm completely with you on the goal of wanting to expand access. I think we all are really concerned about that. I just want to understand a little bit better what you're doing here. So when I look at subdivision 2 of the bill, it's saying that the board can license a person who holds a license in good standing for 5 years in another jurisdiction. Does that person also have to meet other qualifications that somebody in Minnesota would have to meet, or are they able to skip whatever testing or credentialing would happen if they were applying for a new license here?
Mr. Roberts.
I'm going to let our executive director answer the question.
All right, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
My name is Carrie Rexigal, Executive Director of Board of Behavioral Health and Therapy. Representative Liebling, the requirements in other states for counselors are very similar to requirements in Minnesota. That means that if they're licensed, they have met the training, education, examination, and experience required in their respective states. The issue we have with expanding reciprocity is that what we have now is language that says to be licensed by reciprocity, the requirements have to be substantially similar, and our legal counsel has advised what that means. And so sometimes it's not close enough, and that's why we have adopted this proposal on expansion of reciprocity, because it is language that's been provided to all 50 states, and several national organizations have worked on this language. The American Association of State Counseling Boards, the Association for Counselor Education and Supervision, American Mental Health Counselors Association, and the National Board for Certified Counselors. So the language has been worked on and crafted for at least 2 years, it's my recollection. So we are recognizing that other states have determined these individuals are safe to practice in their states, and with the addition of 5 additional years of experience, we're talking full-time employment, that means 10,000 hours. So we feel that our citizens are protected, and we're also then enabling people to be licensed in a more efficient manner in Minnesota through this.
Okay. Well, thank you for that. You know, so I'm an attorney, and when I first came back to Minnesota as an attorney, I got reciprocity because I'd been practicing 5 years. But the reciprocity only allowed me to skip one test. You know, the rest of it had to be checked and up to standards and all of that. So I feel a little bit uncomfortable. I appreciate your explanation, but I'd certainly like to understand better when you say they're all substantially, I forget exactly what words you used, but, you know, that all the states are, you know, in my experience, states vary tremendously in what they require. And, you know, does this mean then that somebody, I don't want to pull out one state that, you know, malign them, but there are states that many of us don't think of as being leaders or being having, you know, the same quality standards that we might have here in Minnesota for a range of things. And so I guess I'd like to have a little more information about what exactly we're exempting, you know, what are we accepting if we do this? Because, you know, it's good if somebody practices for 5 years and doesn't have a complaint against them or they're in good standing, but we all want to expand access, but we want to make sure that the people that we have here serving Minnesotans are high quality also. So I guess I'd like a little more specific information, maybe. I assume this is going to the floor, Mr. Chair, is that where it's going?
Civil law.
Oh, civil law, okay. Well, before it gets to the floor, I think it would be really helpful to have, you know, what's the least stringent state and what's the most stringent state so that we understand what we're getting here when we agree to this. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. Any response to that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, I want to assure you that we have looked at that particular issue very closely before we presented the bill to committee. All applications are reviewed very extensively by an application review committee, and the coursework we make an effort to try to align that coursework with Minnesota standards. If an individual's coursework is not closely aligned, then one of the things that we do, we may require some type of remediation or additional coursework. So we are very much aware of that concern as well. Many of the, particularly in the professional counseling field, most states today, most of their counselor education programs are aligned with national accreditation standards, which are equivalent to, if not higher than, Minnesota. So that is one of the things that we believe will help address some of your concerns. But you can rest assured that one of the things we're looking at is that we are going to, it's not just a carte blanche without reviewing the credentials of the individual if they apply under this proposal.
Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you. And that is helpful. Is there somewhere in the law that it says, then, if this were to pass, that the board may, that the board is going to do that, that the board's authorized to reject somebody or require more coursework or something? Because as I read this, it leaves it a little bit open, and if that's the case and it's not written here somewhere, I could see somebody suing the board.
Ms. Reitzgold.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Liebling. Couple clarifications. Minnesota has kind of a unique continuing education requirement for our professional counselors and clinical counselors. That being, if they have not completed 60 semester credits in counseling coursework, their first continuing education reporting period requires them to complete 12 additional semester credits in counseling coursework to reach 60 credits. We have that, and I think maybe that's what you were referring mm-hmm. to, Dr. Roberts. So there's that, but you're correct, I think, in your reading that reciprocity, if they come in by that method, that means they don't have to have everything perfect, you know, everything exactly like Minnesota. But I'll just reiterate that they have, all of them have master's degrees or doctoral degrees, excuse me, in counseling. They have some supervised practice. They have taken an examination and have completed, maybe I already said this, post-master's supervised practice. So those elements are common across all the states. For the alcohol and drug counselors, there may be some variations because it's a different license, but again, they have met education requirements and examination requirements in their respective states.
Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you. You know, I don't want to belabor this. We've got a lot of bills to go to, but if you could put together something that would kind of show us where the least, what the least stringent states require and what the most stringent states require so that we could get a sense of what somebody might get waived out of. We would, I think that would be helpful. Thank you.
Okay. Are there any other questions for this fire? Seeing none, the committee thanks you for your testimony this morning. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House File 3822? Seeing none, are there any questions for the bill author? Final word, Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for the presentation.
With that, Representative Albright renews his motion that House File 3822 be referred to the Committee on Civil Law and Data Practices Policy. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, and House File 3822 is referred to the Committee on Civil Law and Data Practices Policy. Next, members, we will go to House File 3848. And as we go through that, members, the intention is to do a walkthrough of the bill and then give equal time to the proponents and the opponents. As we go through that, we estimate it will be about 20 minutes each for that, and then we'll take questions.
Representative Schumacher moves HF 3848 to be referred to the Committee on HHS Finance. Representative Schumacher, I understand that you have an A18 amendment. It's an author's amendment. I move the A18 amendment, Representative Schumacher, to your amendment.
No, Mr. Chair, there is no amendment on.
Okay.
Oh.
You didn't follow the script, by the way. No.
All right, Mr. Chair, I do move the A18 amendment.
Thank you for following the script. Okay, Representative Schumacher, to your amendment.
It makes some adjustments to reference lines.
Okay, any discussion on the A18 amendment? Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it does more than that. Representative Schumacher. Maybe Ms. Brecken could explain what it's doing.
Representative Schumacher?
I agree with Representative Liebling that maybe Ms. Brecken can explain the...
Ms. Brecken?
Mr. Chair, my name is Shirley Brecken, and I'm the executive director for the Board of Nursing. There are some, if you look on page 18 of the bill, section 2, that is where all of the amendments are included. The first amendment deletes lines 30 through 33, the reason being that it is... let me back up a minute. There are two parts to this bill. The first part is the Interstate Compact, and then the second part of the bill, Section 2, refers to the applicable of Minnesota law in this situation. The language in the compact, which has been adopted by 29 other states, remains the same. The Section 2, which is applicable to Minnesota law, is called enabling language, and it just references some of the laws in Minnesota in relationship to the compact. The first deletion, as I said, are lines 18.30 through 33 on page 18, and continuing on to page 19, lines 1 through 3. That deletion just really is not necessary because in the compact it says that the individual who practices under the authority of the compact must abide by Minnesota law. So that part was not necessary and was removed, or is proposed to be removed. The next two changes the next changes are renumbering or relettering just because of that deletion. The next one, the deletion is 1911 through 1913, and it just references some of the rules provisions in Minnesota law. And again, because the compact gives the commission authority to promulgate rules according to the model, national model APA, that section is proposed for deletion. The next is the renumbering, lines 1914. Then the next is the deletion, 1917 through 1924. And again, that really references some other laws in Minnesota that are not necessary because, again, the individual must, according to the compact, must practice according to the laws in Minnesota. The next, then, change, of course, is a relettering, changing H to E and I to F. That continues on the next page with the relettering on page 20. Then on lines 20, 14, the deletion is lines 2014 through 2026, and again, because those provisions either, again for the same reason, require the nurse to practice according to the laws in Minnesota, or it deals with some other provisions in terms of reporting in terms of active investigation, and I'll talk about those within the compact.
Thank you, Ms. Brecken. Representative Liebling, any questions?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and just having followed through that, thank you, Ms. Brecken. I think that makes some real changes to the bill. I wonder if, Mr. Chair, if you might want to, if you're going to adopt the amendment now, maybe we should see if anybody wants to testify in opposition to the amendment. I don't know if there would be anybody or not, but it seems to me that this is making substantive changes.
I think we'll adopt the amendment, Representative Liebling, and then we do have quite a few testifiers, pro and con, on this bill, and with the amendment attached, they can address that in their testimony. So, any further discussion, members? Seeing none, then all those in favor of the A18 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay.
No.
The amendment passes. Representative Schumacher, do you have any initial testifiers. I'll just simply repeat. We're going to have 20 minutes of pro and then 20 minutes of con as far as this bill is concerned. So testifiers, please try to keep your comments to approximately 2 minutes so that we have time to hear from all the testifiers this morning. Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members, for your consideration on the House file this morning and for taking up that amendment. This legislation establishes Minnesota's participation in the Enhanced Nurse Licensure Compact. The compact provides Minnesota nurses the opportunity to obtain one multi-state license to practice in multiple states while preserving public protections at the state level. It was developed in the late 1990s by the National Council of State Boards of Nursing to remove major barriers to nursing practicing across state lines and to increase access to nurse care for patients. Since then, the compact has been adopted by 25 states, with more joining each year. Minnesota is not currently a member of the compact, but all four of our border states are. This geographic isolation creates additional burdens for Minnesota nurses that those in neighboring states do not face. Not surprisingly, nurses strongly support Minnesota's joining of the compact. A March 2017 survey of the Minnesota Board of Nursing reveals that over 80% of nurses favor Minnesota's participation in the compact, with fewer than 5% opposing. Of nurses who hold a compact license in another state, 93% of them have said that the compact was beneficial to them. In addition to these benefits for nurses, joining the compact is becoming more important every day as nurses' practice evolves. Minnesota nurses care for patients in all 50 states. The expansion of telehealth services and case management makes the ability for nurses to deliver care across state lines essential. Thank you for your consideration on the bill, and I will have Shirley Brecken now walk through the bill for us.
Ms. Brecken.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Schumacher, members of the committee. This bill, I probably should have been a lot clearer for Representative Liebling. One of the reasons that those deletions now are included, Representative Liebling, is that this is the Enhanced Nurse Licensure Compact. Those pieces of language were when there was the previous compact. Representative Schumacher talked about the fact that that compact was in effect for almost 20 years. However, effective January 19th of this year, 29 states enacted the new Enhanced Nurse Licensure Compact. And the major changes to that compact since its inception, when it was first initiated almost 20 years ago, is to include uniform licensure requirements. That is, the same licensure requirements are required for any nurse who gets a multi-state license. That was not the case in the previous compact, and it was one of the concerns that many states raised and then did not enter into the compact. This bill enacts that enhanced a nurse license compact whereby a nurse obtains one license in his or her home state or state of residence, and that license, like a driver's license, allows the nurse to practice across borders and practice in all other states. Regardless of the laws of the state where the license is issued, the nurse is required to practice according to the laws of the state where the practice occurs, or that is where the patient is located, which is the same again as our driver's license. You know, the speed limit may vary from one state to the next, but you must abide by that law in that particular state regardless of where you are licensed. The home state issues the nurse license, and then the nurse may practice in another compact state. Only the home state, that the state that issues the license, can take action against that license. However, every party state, all of the other states within the compact, can take action against the multi-state privilege. And that's very much the same that we have today with the four states that border Minnesota. A number of years ago, in anticipation of practice across state borders, the legislature passed what we call the border state law. And that law allows a nurse from Wisconsin, Iowa, North Dakota, or South Dakota to practice nursing in Minnesota on that state's license. However, there is not reciprocity. In other words, Minnesota nurses licensed in Minnesota cannot go to Wisconsin, North Dakota, South Dakota, or Iowa and practice under that license. That's a difference with the compact. With the compact, there is the agreement that those borders don't exist and we move across those borders. Another thing that's really important about the compact is that the generally the party state or the, where the practice occurs is the one that if a violation occurs and a patient files a complaint with the Board of Nursing, that board in the state where the patient is located generally will carry out the investigation, but in cooperation with the state of licensure. So if the state, if Minnesota were to join the compact and to, would take action against the multi-state license privilege, that privilege then would be communicated to the National Data Bank, nurses, the coordinated licensure system, and all of the states in the all of the party states would know that action has been taken. Especially if the state of licensure takes action against that license, there is no longer a multi-state privilege because the individual doesn't have the authority then to cross the borders. They might still have a single state license, but they won't have a multi-state license. Article 1 of the bill provides for definitions, and again, of importance is the definition of the home state. The home state issues the license so the nurse can practice in any party state. Article 2 provides the uniform licensure requirements an individual must meet to be eligible for a multi-state license. And as I said, this is a major change from the original compact. In fact, what this did was raise the bar for a multi-state, the requirements for a multi-state license. Lines 3.17 through 4.5 are common to Minnesota right now. The individual must have graduated from an approved school of nursing. They must pass the national nurse examination, that is NCLEX, and they must submit to a fingerprint-based criminal background check. Lines 4.6 through 4.14 list requirements that are more strict than what we have now in Minnesota to get a nurse license. The individual can never have been convicted of a felony. They cannot ever have been convicted of a misdemeanor offense that is related to the practice of nursing. For example, theft from a patient. They cannot be enrolled in an alternative program, such as the Health Professional Services Program, and they must have a Social Security number. These are all requirements that are greater or more strict than a single state license in Minnesota right now. So the bar was raised on who can get a multi-state license. If a nurse doesn't meet these requirements, the nurse cannot get a multi-state license and will not have that multi-state privilege to practice in other states. Article 3 requires the state to submit data to and use data from a national coordinated licensure system. That system is NURSIS, N-U-R-S-Y-S. Our article also limits the nurse to only one multi-state license, and it outlines the process for change of licensure if the nurse changes residence or moves from one state to another. Article 4 provides the authority to take adverse action against the multi-state licensure privilege. So the Board of Nursing in Minnesota would have the same authority, the same jurisdiction to take action against the multi-state privilege as it does to take against the nurse license in Minnesota. It also provides for the commission to issue subpoenas or for a board to issue subpoenas. Last year, this legislature passed the Physician Interstate Licensure Compact. And I would tell you that Articles 5 through 10 are very similar, if in many instances the same as the provisions provided in that Physician's Compact. It addresses the coordinated licensure system and how the information must be exchanged. Article 6 establishes the governing body or the interstate commission, like the physician compact adopted last year by this legislature. Article 7 allows for rules to be adopted by the commission. Such rulemaking authority has been permitted and exercised by other interstate compacts, and again, is very similar and, in fact, alike the physician compact adopted by this legislature last year. Article 8 ensures compliance with the Enhanced Nurse Licensure Compact member states and provides procedures in the event of a failure of a party state to comply with the Enhanced Nurse Licensure Compact. Again, like the Physician Compact. And Article 9 addresses the method to enter, withdraw from, or amend the ENLC, like the Physician Compact. And Article 10 provides for the compact to remain valid in a state when any provision is declared to be contrary to a party state's constitution. I believe I've gone through the other parts of the bill, Section 2 of the bill, and with that said, I would stand for questions.
Thank you, Ms. Birkin, for that overview. I think at this time we'll take the pro-testifiers on the bill, and we'd like you to come forward if you support the bill and want to testify. I would suggest that you keep your testimony to approximately 10 minutes, two minutes if at all possible, because we have a number of testifiers. Also, if you wish to testify for this bill, there's open chairs behind Chair Schumacher. I appreciate if you'd move down there so that we could keep the rotation moving as quickly as possible. With that, welcome to the committee. Can you please introduce yourself and give your testimony?
Mr. Chair and members of committee, my name is Diane Twiddell. I'm a registered nurse and immediate past president of the Minnesota Organization of Leaders in Nursing, MOLN. And I'm speaking on behalf of MOLN in support of House File 3848, Nurse Licensure Compact. The MOLN is a nonprofit organization that consists of nurse leaders that throughout the state and give nurse leaders a collective voice in guiding nursing and impacting the healthcare system in Minnesota. I'm here today to share that MOLN Impact supports Minnesota in joining the Nurse Licensure Compact. The NLC increases access to healthcare, protects patient safety, reduces costs, and supports state-of-the-art healthcare delivery. It also enhances nurses' mobility across states and allows nurses to quickly cross state borders when there is a disaster. The NLC is also cost-effective. It provides both for organizations and individual nurses for organizational nurses and individual nurses to pay for licensure fees for multiple state licenses because they provide telehealth care across state lines or direct patient care such as flight nurses across state lines. What is frequently happens is we see that we have patients who travel, go into another state, and we have to deliver that care. MOLN sees adoption of the NLC in Minnesota as providing Minnesota nurses with the opportunity to provide their expertise and skilled nurse services to patients in border states and in currently 29 states throughout the country more efficiently. We are all working to provide our patients with the best health care. Our care models have evolved. Instead of patients coming to us to receive care, we are delivering care where the patient is. And many times this is through a telephone visit, a virtual visit through iPad technology, or even through an e-visit through an electronic email exchange. We recognize we're not going to be treating patients the same in the future as we are today, and we need to be prepared to meet the needs of our patients and evolve to accommodate new models of care. The NLC helps provide and break down state boundaries that are not relevant in providing patients with safe, quality care. Representative Schumacher referenced a survey done by the Minnesota Board of Nursing in 2017. Almost 40% of all respondents reported that they had provided nursing services to and or communicated with patients or clients located in a state other than the state of Minnesota. Critics of the Nurse Licensure Compact will cite that because the compact does not require continuing ed hours, that less competent and less educated nurses will provide care in the state of Minnesota. A study by the National Council of State Boards of Nursing concludes that there is no evidence that completion of continuing education requirements equates to competence. Research shows that nurses tend to accumulate continuing education hours whether or not they are mandated to do so.
In states where continuing education is not mandated, licensees complete an average of 32 hours of continuing education, and more often complete continuing education that relates to their practice setting or specialization. It's time for the NLC in Minnesota. Minnesota is seen as a national leader in safe, quality health care. Our patients do not stay within the circumscribed boundaries of Minnesota at all times. Why should we expect our nurses to have to conform to the same boundaries with their practice? It's time for us to support a nurse licensure system that supports our health care system. Thank you for your time and consideration of this bill.
Thank you, Ms. Claudel. Is there any other testifiers on the bill? Please come forward and introduce yourself and try to keep your testimony within 2 minutes if possible.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Christine Miller. I am representing the Minnesota Association of Colleges of Nursing, an organization of the 20 schools of nursing in Minnesota offering baccalaureate and higher degrees. I also serve as the Associate Dean for Academic Programs at the University of Minnesota School of Nursing. I'm speaking in support of House File 3848. The Nurse Licensure Compact has important implications for schools of nursing that offer graduate degrees. Individuals seeking a graduate degree in a school of nursing are already registered nurses. They may be in a master's program or a doctor of nursing practice program, studying to be, for example, a nurse practitioner, a nurse midwife, a nurse administrator, or a nurse educator. Many graduate nursing programs provide flexibility to their students by using some online course delivery. This results in graduate students living in other states who are enrolled in Minnesota graduate nursing programs. These out-of-state students prefer to do their practicum experiences in their home state. And for some of these states, because Minnesota is not part of the Nurse Licensure Compact, the faculty have to be licensed in the state where the student resides, especially for supervision of their practicum. Let me illustrate a situation for nurses in South Dakota who wish to attend a graduate nursing program in Minnesota. The South Dakota Board of Nursing requires that if a Minnesota graduate nursing program admits a student residing in South Dakota, faculty who teach any course that the student takes has to be licensed as an RN in South Dakota. What that means for the Doctor of Nursing Practice program at the University of Minnesota, for example, is that approximately 20 faculty would need a South Dakota nursing license. If Minnesota was a compact state for nurse licensure, we could accept students from any of the compact states and significantly minimize barriers for these students who want to learn in Minnesota graduate nursing programs. It would further reduce the significant burden on the graduate nursing programs in Minnesota, needing to keep informed about the regulations for all boards of nursing in the United States and paying for additional license for faculty. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Miller. Is there any other testifiers who in favor of the bill would want to come forward at this time? Okay, please introduce yourself and try to keep your testimony within 2 minutes. Thank you.
Chair Schumacher and members of the committee, my name is Jane Foote. I'm a registered nurse, associate professor of nursing in the department chair at Winona State University. I live in Rochester, Minnesota, and I teach in both Winona and Rochester. I teach the health policy courses. I'm one of the grassroots liaisons also for the Minnesota Association of Colleges of Nursing, although I'm speaking on my behalf. I'd like to share with you my experience and supportive position for HF 3848, specifically how it benefits our students. I'm speaking to you in favor because it allows nurses to more easily cross over our neighboring states to provide care. As previously mentioned by Shirley Brecken, nursing care happens where the patient is. And we know that care happens in many ways via telemedicine, and that's likely to increase in the future. At this time in Minnesota, nurses need to have multiple state licensures because we're not part of the compact. Safe preparation in nursing education happens at the national level. So our licenses happen nationally. We teach nursing from national textbooks. And it's very important to understand that there's not a Minnesota-specific information that we provide our nursing students throughout our programs. The driver's license analogy has already been mentioned. I recently went to South Dakota on spring break, and I wasn't required to have a South Dakota license to pass my car through that state, but I was expected to understand and abide by all those South Dakota laws. It's a similar analogy for the state nursing license compact. I have one more story specific to teaching nursing that may be of interest to the committee. As you know, beautiful Winona is located on the border between Minnesota and Wisconsin. Our Winona-based students attend clinical in Minnesota and Wisconsin, and we often have Wisconsin nurses supervise our Winona State students when they attend clinicals in La Crosse. Because we're not part of the compact, these Wisconsin nurse faculty must apply for Minnesota licensure by endorsement to teach our Minnesota students, even though those clinicals are happening in Wisconsin. You likely have heard that the nursing faculty shortage is real, and it impacts our capacity to take additional students. Becoming part of the compact will help remove this additional barrier for these faculty. In summary, I think that the nurse compact removes barriers for colleges to hire qualified faculty. It facilitates admission of students living in other states, as described by Dr. Miller, and it facilitates nursing practice for our own Minnesota RNs. It's not a new or untested compact, and it is aligned with national standards for practice. I urge you to support the passage of this legislation, and I encourage any questions that you have. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Bush, for your testimony. Are there any other testifiers in support of the bill? Seeing none, we will move to those who have concerns or oppose the bill. Again, I'd recommend that if you're going to testify, that you would come down and be seated behind Chair Schumacher so we can make the rotation as quickly and efficiently as possible. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and try to keep your testimony within 2 minutes, if at all possible.
Thank you, Chair. And committee, my name is Catherine Kane. I am a registered nurse and the executive director of the Minnesota Organization of Registered Nurses, Minnesota's member of the American Nurses Association. Our members are RNs and APRNs located throughout the state. These members are employed in settings that include acute care, long-term care, home care, education policy, forensics. We refer to our members representing the community of nurses because of the variety of roles and settings in which they are employed. In regards to HF 3848, which would have nurses in Minnesota join the already created Nurse Licensure Compact, the Minnesota Organization of Registered Nurses believes that issues surrounding the compact are too complex to be adequately considered during this short legislative session. While the MNRN supports strategies that allow nurses to practice across boundaries, we believe those strategies should maintain Minnesota's ability to have jurisdiction over the Minnesota Nurse Practice Act, including the disciplinary complaint process. In 2013, following a series of articles about nurses getting in trouble and having second chances, and a subsequent report from the Office of the Legislative Auditor about the complaint resolution process, the Minnesota Legislature clearly identified the importance of the legislature in ensuring that the Board of Nursing has appropriate authority to discipline nurses, while ensuring also that individual nurses' rights are maintained. MNRN strongly supports that the legislature maintain its authority in these disciplinary and complaint resolution matters. In a YouTube posted by the National Council of State Boards of Nursing in June of 2017, which addressed the discipline process under the Enhanced Nurse Licensure Compact, the executive director of the Idaho Board of Nursing made some comments about the licensure compact in general before going into more depth about the disciplinary process. She said some things that are troubling to MNRN. She said, what's considered to be a violation in one state may not be a violation in another state. She said, once adopted, the compact actually takes precedence over your own state law. She gave the example of Idaho had introduced three bills that hadn't passed prior to the adoption of the compact, and she said that after the compact was adopted, they didn't have to go back to the Idaho legislature, that the changes were accomplished through the compact itself. She said also that an act may be a violation in one state law, but not a violation of another state law, that forms and levels of discipline, including fine suspension, taking classes, participating in a monitoring program, differ from state to state, and that actions you can take against a nurse are limited by state law. As stated by the executive director of the Idaho Board of Nursing, each state has its own grounds for discipline and disciplinary complaint process. Under the proposed nurse licensure compact, if adopted, nurses in Minnesota could be disciplined in states referred to as remote states as well as in Minnesota. It could be possible for a nurse to go through a disciplinary complaint process in multiple states, all with different processes and different grounds for discipline. Just the cost of hiring attorneys in multiple states would likely be prohibited on a nurse's salary. While the Nurse Licensure Compact provides a solution for practicing nurses across borders, components of the NLC deserve a full and informed hearing at the Capitol. Besides the disciplinary and complaint resolution, there are issues around the coordination of licensure information system and exchange of information, the establishment of the Interstate Commission of Nurse Licensure Compact Administration, administrators and their authority in rulemaking, and the construction and severability that needs to be clearly understood so that the legislature can be assured that they are maintaining their authority over the Minnesota Board of Nursing and the practice of nursing in our state. MNRN asks that HF 3848, the Nurse Licensure Compact created and money appropriated, not be considered during this legislative session. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Kane. Next testifier would like to come forward and introduce yourself. Try to keep your testimony within 2 minutes if possible.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Shannon Cunningham, and I'm the Director of Governmental Relations for the Minnesota Nurses Association. I'm here today on behalf of the 22,000 registered nurses who work at the bedside in Minnesota hospitals. We respectfully ask that you vote against the Interstate Nurse Licensure Compact. You heard earlier some information about a survey that the Minnesota Board of Nursing had sent out. MNA has some great concerns about that survey. While it appears that the majority of the nurses are supportive of joining the compact, actually only a fraction of nurses surveyed responded. Those who did respond were first required to read leading statements about the compact without being told of any of the potential drawbacks. This included statements telling respondents that joining the compact, quote, would ultimately serve to improve patient care and safety, but it also declined to inform them about any of the potential risks. Additional concerns around the compact relate to revenue loss. In previous years, the Board of Nursing indicated that there will be a decrease of renewals and subsequent renewal fees due to the implementation of the compact in Minnesota. This loss of revenue to the board will likely result in an increase of licensure fees to actual Minnesota nurses, as was found in other states who joined the compact. In Virginia alone, they reported that joining the compact would result in a $200,000 annual loss for the state. It's logical to assume that any loss as significant as that will need to be recouped by increasing licensing fees on Minnesota's own nurses. Minnesota statute also requires that the Board of Nursing maintain a record of all people licensed by the board to practice nursing. Unfortunately, if Minnesota joins the compact, nurses from other compact states will not have records maintained by our Board of Nursing. Currently, even nurses who live in those border states that are affected by border reciprocity are required to report to the Minnesota Board of Nursing within 10 days of practicing in the state. Given that our board's mission is to protect the public's health and safety through regulation of nursing, education, licensure, and practice, it would seem that this loss of information would be challenging to that mission. Additionally, the Board of Nursing will not be able to require compact nurses to abide by the same continuing education standards. While a previous testifier said that continuing education requirements are unnecessary, the Minnesota Nurses Association disagrees. You recently heard a bill requiring 2 hours of continuing education on opioids for all prescribers. If the legislature wanted to extend this or a different requirement upon registered nurses, we would be prohibited from asking any of those thousands of compact nurses working in Minnesota to abide by this regulation. This could severely limit our ability to address and control problems through continuing education. Proponents of the bill also claim that it would bridge the shortage of nurses in greater Minnesota. However, receiving a nursing license is already a simplified process. Under our current system, nurses wanting to come to Minnesota from other states merely need to apply for a temporary license from the Board of Nursing, pay a licensing fee, and begin their practice in Minnesota. Nurses from bordering states are required to follow a similar process, but they're even exempt from paying the licensing fee. We have yet to understand the need to bypass this system. As you've seen during the recent 2010-2016 nurses strike, the hospitals around Minnesota had no issues in bringing nurses into the state to practice. Telehealth has also been mentioned as a primary concern for health systems wishing to operate across state lines via electronic health. Despite multiple requests to discuss ways to address this outside of the compact, health systems have yet to bring an alternate solution to telehealth forward. Given that states such as Wisconsin have been able to change their telehealth requirements to allow continued telehealth care following appointments, we believe that other solutions should be explored in Minnesota first. Lastly, one of our largest areas of concern with the enhanced compact is that it will increase the number of nurses from states who come here working with lower standards. While it's true, every nurse in the country takes the NCLEX exam, an exam is not the same as a practice. Each state has their own unique set of practice rules that dictate what a nurse is allowed and isn't allowed to do. Unfortunately, there's no exam that tests regulations around practice. We thank you for your time today, and on behalf of the 22,000 members of M&A, we ask that you vote no. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Cunningham. Is there any other testifiers opposing the bill or with concerns? Please come forward and introduce yourself and give your testimony. If you could keep it to 2 minutes, if at all possible.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Sharon Carlson. I'm a bedside nurse that works in perioperative care center at Abbott Northwestern Hospital. Perioperative care is the care that is given before, during, and after surgery. As well as being a staff nurse, I've had the privilege of being a charge nurse in our pre-op post-anesthesia care unit, day surgery, and our cardiovascular recovery areas. I've been a registered nurse for 20 years, and the last 10 of which have been at Abbott Northwestern Hospital. I'm here today to ask you to vote against the Nursing Licensure Compact. I can testify that if Minnesota joins the National Nurse Licensure Compact, we will open the floodgates to out-of-state nurses who will come to work in our hospitals. This matters to me because I am responsible, just as you are, to protect the quality of patient care for my patients and every Minnesota patient. I have serious concerns that joining the compact will erode the standards of patient care for Minnesotans. How do I know this? Because I have experienced firsthand the knowledge deficits of each and every traveler that comes into my department. As a charge nurse, my job is to review the work and the documentation of nurses in my unit. And I routinely have to correct and remind out-of-state nurses of proper procedure and safe practice. For example, we had a spine surgery patient fresh out of the operating room. They must have a no exam every 15 minutes for the first hour after surgery. But the agency or traveler nurses don't follow this practice, nor did they do a complete neuro exam. I instructed them on basic practice and following the physician's orders. The response was, we don't have to do full neuro exams or checks or frequent exams where we came from. Another example is narcotic administration. Administration and documentation for our surgical population is crucial in the recovery of a patient. I had to educate the travel nurses daily to document pain assessments of the patient and effectiveness of the pain medication after it was given, which is a standard practice in Minnesota. This means literally asking the patient, what's the level of your pain on a number scale? It's not difficult, it's routine. I also had to instruct them on the correct pain regimens. When I returned to Abbott after the Allina strike in 2016, I was shocked to experience how nursing was being practiced by our replacements that had been licensed by our own Minnesota Board of Nursing. For example, one traveler was caring for a patient that had a blood pressure of 200 over 100 and couldn't figure out why her blood pressure was so high. The patient had neosinephrine drip running, which is routinely used to assist with elevating blood pressure during surgery instead of giving lots of IV fluids. The traveler didn't know the drug and didn't realize it was running. This is a common drug that's used in every day in our critical care areas. I had to point out to this and instruct the travel nurse to stop the medication. Another replacement nurse gave two tablets of Percocet to a patient that had received already a gram of IV Tylenol. Percocet has Tylenol in it, and the patient had received too much Tylenol in such a short period of time. High doses of Tylenol is toxic to the liver. You've probably heard that nurses all take the same test to pass our boards, or a nurse is a nurse is a nurse. If you're ever the one in a hospital bed, you'll realize the difference comes in what nurses learn on the job. Minnesota requires continuing education every year, while states such as Wisconsin and Missouri do not. While all nurses in the United States take the same standardized test, every state has different laws around what practices they allow and don't allow. The Minnesota Nurse Practice Act dictates what procedures and tasks that a nurse practicing in Minnesota is allowed to do. Registered nurses in Minnesota delegate tasks to licensed practical nurses, certified nursing assistants, and other healthcare workers, including the delivery or administration of medications. RNs must know, for example, Minnesota RNs are the only ones that can push IV medications. They cannot delegate that task. Because there is no way to verify that nurses from other states who are practicing nursing in Minnesota are aware and compliant with our Practice Act, it is a liability to Minnesota patients. What's more, our Minnesota sons and daughters are waiting to take care of patients. There are waiting lists for all nursing schools. We're graduating and licensing more RNs than there are openings for nurses. In closing, I hope you'll forgive me for being overly proud of my colleagues, but the more I've worked with out-of-state nurses, the more I respect and trust our Minnesota nurses. Only in Minnesota do our high standards and continued education lead us to practice our nursing skills, beholden not to a doctor or a hospital, but to the patient. We operate as independent thinkers to monitor and care for our patients. We question and examine orders to ensure that patients are truly getting better. It's rare to see that kind of critical thinking practice anywhere else. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Carlson. Is there anyone else here with concerns or opposing this bill? We've used up about 14 minutes of the 20 minutes of testimony we have on this as part of the agenda. Okay, seeing none, any questions from the testifiers, members? Representative Grisha.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you for the bill. Interesting conversation. I'm trying to get my hands around this. I've heard this as well when we deal with other things, especially in education. And I'm wondering if the testifier from Winona State, the faculty person, and Ms. Cunningham could come back up. I just have a couple questions for both of those two, Mr. Chair.
Please come forward and go ahead, Representative Grisha.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, I'm really trying to understand this, the claim of the inferior standards. And so one of the comments that came up was there'll be an increased number of nurses with lower standards. I understand the rhetoric of that, but my true question is, are these really inferior nurses just because they live in a geographically different spot? And I understand the pride of working with your colleagues in Minnesota, but you know, a nurse that comes from another state that now is working next to you side by side, their colleague, is that pride still translate to them? So I'm really trying to understand the reality of this. I just can't believe because standards are different that they're inferior in their job capabilities. And I'll let both of you respond.
To the testifiers, whoever wants to respond to that question.
Yeah. So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I would certainly never describe someone who has gone through the rigorous training requirements to become a nurse as inferior. However, there are some fairly significant differences in the practices of each of the individual states. So, as you heard from the nurses up here testifying, a nurse in a southern state would have a significantly different practice act than a nurse perhaps in Minnesota. And so you're taking a burden of requiring that this person to know all of the additional requirements in Minnesota. Anecdotally, we've heard from our members that working side by side with a nurse from a different state, and it is, I hate to say it, but it's especially some of the southern states, is significantly different than working with a nurse who was raised and trained in Minnesota under Minnesota's Nurse Practice Act. So while I don't have any data to show you today, I can tell tell you that, you know, the hundreds of conversations I've had with Minnesota nurses, they see a significant difference in working side by side with those individuals. Yes, of course, you're still going to have camaraderie. I mean, you know, even if I'm working in my office next to someone who maybe isn't as good at my job as I am, I would still like them and I would still enjoy working with them, but that isn't necessarily a test of their capabilities as a nurse.
Representative Fischer.
Mr. Chair, if you have a testifier, could respond.
Hi, Jane Foote from Winona State. Thank you for your question. When I graduated from St. Olaf College in 1982, there were no jobs in Minnesota as a baccalaureate prepared nurse. I headed to Nashville, Tennessee, so I have worked in the South for 4 years, and I can testify about my practice at that time working at Vanderbilt Children's Hospital on a very intensive care. This care is not different in the South. In 2012, I worked for the National League for Nursing Accrediting Commission in Georgia. I had to get a Georgia state license. They were actually more stringent on me having recent clinical practice and tracking my scores back to my original national test score than we were here in Minnesota when I returned. I've been licensed in 6 states. I've practiced nursing in 6 states. The concerns that our staff nurse colleague noted are very serious, very concerning, and as a faculty member, I would say that's an individual nurse not being up to date on her practice. That is not a nurse from out of state not knowing good practice. I can testify that as a nurse educator, we have very high standards, and I teach in the undergrad program right through our doctoral program and grad program. Practice is always delivered by individual nurses, and each individual nurse has to maintain their own knowledge and expertise and know when they don't know something and ask for help. We teach that at every level of nursing education. So I don't agree, I respectfully disagree with the idea that Southern nurses have a different level of practice or less education. I have practiced in those states, and I've worked at the national level at an accrediting commission that accredits programs nationally. I know that that's not true in my experience. Thank you.
Representative Crescia.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I really respect both viewpoints on this. I'm trying to understand. So I'm trying to flip this around the other way. Let's say I have an incredible amount of pride for the Minnesota people that I serve. And when another state that's arguing against us, they could say the same things about our Minnesota nurses, correct? They have different standards, therefore it's lower. And so that argument applies basically depending on which boundary you're at. So, I mean, I wouldn't say you would. We certainly wouldn't suggest that's true of our nurses, that they're coming into a different state with different standards, therefore, and whatever inferences you want to draw. I mean, how would you respond to that, Mr. Chair?
To the testifiers, does anyone want to respond to that question?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think if you look at the ranking of Minnesota when it comes to where we stand in healthcare compared to other states, I mean, I really think that speaks for itself. And, you know, maybe I'm not very humble about it, but I really think that that is in a great deal attributed to the nurses who practice here in the state of Minnesota.
Ms. Foote, do you have a comment?
If I were to kind of look globally at the situation, of course we take pride in our Minnesota healthcare systems and the way that we train our nurses and our practice standards. I think the issue is a bit different. It's about imagining that there are differences in professionalism in nursing that I'm not sure having taught across other states for students that are in other states. That's really true. I would like to think that nationally, nursing is a profession that we are the most trusted profession, survey after survey, and that has nothing to do with which state you happen to have your home in. It has to do with how the public perceives us and the responsibility we take as individual nurses for the care that we provide.
Representative Crescia.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to both the testifiers. It was very helpful. And I would submit, I believe, you know, this is not a new conversation. In 2011, it had passed. We were working on a conference committee, and so this stuff is. But I would just submit, I think there's lots of other policy considerations to talk around whether or not this is a good idea or not. But just me personally, talking about the different level of standards, we've done it with education. I think removing the people from this is helpful because I don't really see the case of saying, because I take the idea that if I'm a Minnesota nurse, I move to Wisconsin, then I move back, or I move to another state, that I bring those standards with me. I believe the nurses are very capable, and they're going to learn, and they're going to adapt. And so I would just throw that out for consideration. That let's look at the other compact policies around this, Mr. Chair.
Well, thank you. Representative Stanstead.
Good morning. This question is either for Ms. Cunningham or Ms. Carlson. I think there's very compelling arguments on both sides of this issue, and my question for you would be, what would it take to make you more comfortable with a compact? What kind of criteria would you be looking for to say, okay, we would be more amenable to this?
To the testifiers, whoever wants to respond.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think that there are a few things that would make us more comfortable. One would be if we were able to be assured that the Board of Nursing would know which of these nurses were practicing here in Minnesota. You know, like we testified, we will not know any of the nurses who are practicing from compact states. We would feel more comfortable if the nurses who are practicing from compact states were not grandfathered into the background requirements on the new nurse licensure compact. Unfortunately, any nurse who is currently licensed in one of, I believe it's the 26 compact states, is grandfathered into those requirements in the enhanced compact. I think we would feel more comfortable if we were to know that there was some liability on the, whether it's the employer or the Board of Nursing, to really make sure that the nurses practicing from other states were tested on our Nurse Practice Act and really were sure that they were working to those standards. I mean, one of our fears is, if we pass the compact, we could set up a system where you have like a telehealth center, and a nurse working at that telehealth center could be able to work in every single one of those compact states. And so they would be expected to know all 26 and rising number of nurse licensure compacts and what they are and aren't allowed to do. And that really makes us nervous. I don't know if you have any additional.
I don't think so.
Representative Stanford.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question goes to the first testifier, Ms. Kane, and if Ms. Brecken could approach. I have a question that I'd like both to respond to. Good morning.
Good morning.
Ms. Kane, in your testimony, you referenced some comments made about from someone that was in your presence about the inability to discipline or enforce state law. My first question is to the point of, was that legal opinion offered, or was that conjecture on the part of the person you were
talking about? This wasn't a YouTube presentation that was on the NCSBN website. That was from the executive director of the Idaho Board of Nursing.
Mr. Chair and Ms. Kane, so then it was conjecture?
I don't believe it was conjecture, because it was in a meeting that was from the National Council, and there were National Council attorneys in the room also. I think that she was sharing her experience in Idaho when they passed the compact.
Representative Albright.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Ms. Kane. I'll take that as conjecture. Then to the point, following on to that, you referenced, based upon this YouTube video, that the compact would, in a sense, comport then that Minnesota state law would be subordinate to the compact. Was that also conjecture, or was that a legal opinion rendered by the Idaho Department?
Ms. Kane.
Thank you. It was from the executive director of the Board of Nursing from the Idaho.
Ms. Brecken, in your opinion, based upon the bill or the amendment that was adopted, would the compact disallow Minnesota state law to supersede the compact in discipline or enforcement measures?
Ms. Brecken.
Chair, excuse me, Representative Albright, no, the compact actually provides that jurisdiction, that any nurse practicing in Minnesota, whether it is under a Minnesota license or a multi-state privilege based on a license in another compact state, would have authority to take the same type of disciplinary action, use the same grounds for disciplinary action that are in the Minnesota Nurse Practice Act. I'd also like to comment on the video that Ms. Kane referred to, because I've seen that video. And I think that the question, I'm not sure, you know, initially your question was related to the compact and the executive director of the Idaho Board of Nursing. You know, that I think what she stated was that there are instances where something is a violation in one state, but it's not in another. An example that I'd give you is, for instance, in Minnesota, we have there's a requirement that the Board of Nursing, along with other health licensing boards, suspend or revoke the license of an individual that doesn't pay their taxes or is delinquent in their taxes or doesn't meet their child support payments. Those kinds of laws are, you know, sometimes in some states they're similar and in many states they're not. So that was the reference that she made to those social kinds of laws. I think the really important thing to recognize is that, again, that it's the standard of practice within and the laws within the given state where the nurse is practicing, where the patient is, that apply in regards to the practice of the individual. And each board has the authority to take action against that privilege.
Thank you,
Representative Ballberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Ms. Brick and Ms. Kane. So I guess my sense is that the compact does not disallow Minnesota from enforcing its own sovereign nature with regard to nursing licensure or, for that matter, discipline. So I appreciate your comments.
Okay, with that, we'll go to Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've been somewhat familiar with this topic for a few decades since my mother-in-law retired from Mayo. She worked subbing for labor and delivery nurses across the nation and had to be licensed in, I think that at the end she was licensed in 18 different states. And then when I moved back to Minnesota, my wife, who had worked under the doctor's orders as a nurse in Arizona, because it was so complex and difficult to repeat everything to get Minnesota licensure, didn't. And so I'm glad to see we're looking at this, but I'd like some clarity, and I think it's Ms. Brecken is with the Minnesota Board of Nursing. And one of the testifiers from the MNA indicated that a very small portion of nurses actually responded to the survey, and looking at the material that was handed out to members, that small number was 21K, and that's what 22K are part of the MNA. So the small, you know, I wonder if the MNA considers that they are a small number of the nurses. So am I correct that it's about 21,000 that responded?
Ms. Beckin?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kwan, yes, the survey was sent to approximately 127,000 nurses in Minnesota for whom we have email addresses. The response rate, as you said, was almost 21,000 nurses, and we worked, you know, with an IRB and some national statisticians, and we're assured that that was a more than representative sample of the Minnesota nurses.
Representative Fong.
Thank you, and I would agree. But also looking through that data, it seemed to indicate that 20% were from outside the state of Minnesota. What portion would be from, I guess, the neighboring states where we have reciprocity?
Ms. Burton.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kwan, the largest response of those from out of state was from the state of Wisconsin. And that is, you know, that is true actually in terms of the border state registry. The highest number are nurses from Wisconsin, and I think that just speaks to our borders, you know, between Mayo and the Twin Cities and Duluth, being that close to, you know, those large healthcare facilities and being that close to the Wisconsin border, that would be the expectation.
Representative Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so members, you know, I would sort of disagree with the comment that MNA has for a small, insignificant sample of the nurses taking it, because if we accepted that, we would have to then say MNA believes that their membership is a small, insignificant portion of the you know, population of nurses, because they're basically the same number. And that I think the major fears of the nurses' compact are we're going to be flooded with nurses from other states. Well, frankly, the nurses from outside tend to be from the bordering states, which are already part of the nurses' compact, which already have reciprocity. Well, basically, they're allowed to practice in Minnesota the way it is. So I don't think there's going to be a major issue. And I think that, especially considering that we have so many patients, at least in the little clinic in my area, hundreds of thousands, I think, from outside the borders of Minnesota, that we're no longer in the 1800s, 1900s, you know, we're in the 21st century. We communicate and we travel, and I think if I have an appointment with a doctor, I ought to be able to call in the following week with a question and speak to that, to the nurse. And frankly, unless we're part of this compact, it's really tough for all those hundreds of thousands of people that visit our doctors, our medical facilities, which are some of the best in the world, to be able to talk to that nurse, because unless they're licensed across this, you know, nation, or part of it, you know, we're part of the compact, it makes it difficult to provide that common sense coverage. Thank you.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question probably either directed to Ms. Cunningham or Ms. Brecken. I thought it was interesting, one of the testifiers brought up that how continuing education would or wouldn't be impacted by this, and specifically I think one of the testifiers talked about one of the pieces of legislation we've discussed this session around the opioid epidemic and whatnot. So, you know, as a lawmaker, it's interesting. I want to think about how the laws that come through here and the things we think about do or don't play with this. So could I get comment and to better understand how continuing education that we pass through here as requirements would or wouldn't be impacted by this compact agreement?
To the testifiers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. So under the compact, if Minnesota were to join the compact, nurses who have their home license in Minnesota, so all the nurses who are currently registered in Minnesota, would still need to abide by Minnesota's requirement to have the 24 continuing education credits every cycle. Unfortunately, we would be unable to require any of the nurses who come from those compact states who may be practicing in Minnesota to abide by that same standard. So there would be a little bit of a disparity there if, for example, you wanted to extend the opioid regulation on continuing education to every nurse who was ever practicing in Minnesota. You'd be unable to do that for those compact nurses. You would still be able to do that for the current nurses who are registered under our board.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that helps clarify to know then when we talk about if this were to pass legislation moving forward around continuing education would only pertain to a certain group of nurses practicing in Minnesota. So I think that has some pretty significant impact, and I appreciate the comment on that. Thank you.
Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, Representative Olson completely anticipated my question. You know, we had a lot of discussion here with regard to physicians requiring them to have some continuing education on opioids, and I think we passed that unanimously out of this committee, even though, you know, I'm kind of, you know, uncomfortable telling professionals what they should do, and yet we were all pretty convinced that that was something that we thought that physicians who were prescribing or authorized to prescribe opioids should have some, we should know, we wanted to know as a committee that they would all have this education. And so, I mean, I heard Ms. Twiddell say that continuing education hours don't equate to competence. And I'm sure that's true in itself, and yet Ms. Brecken, as the executive director of the Board of Nursing, I mean, the Board of Nursing requires certain continuing education. As a lawyer, I have to take it. Every professional, I think, in Minnesota has to take continuing education. And I don't know, I wonder, you know, I got the answer to my real question about what this does to that, but I have to say it does concern me some then that if we decide, say, that we want to make sure that every nurse practicing in Minnesota has a certain basic understanding of a subject area, say opioids, that we then have lost control and given away control of that. And, of course, we won't know under the compact who's coming into Minnesota and who's practicing here under the multi-state license, because the Board of Nursing won't have that information. So I think there are many really beneficial things about a compact. A lot of them have been stated, but I have to say that there are a couple of aspects like that that do sort of give me pause. So thank you.
Okay. Any other questions for the testifiers, members? Ms. Brecken?
Mr. Chair, Representative Olson, I'm sorry I didn't get a chance to respond to your question. The requirement for continuing education in Minnesota is that a nurse does 24 hours of continuing ed, the registered nurse, every 2 years, and 12 hours of continuing education for LPNs every 2 years. That is a mandatory requirement for renewal of the license. For the vast majority of nurses, that continuing education is provided by their employers, and it's provided by their employers either in a contractual, you know, it's in their contract, their union contract, to provide that, or employers, of course, recognize that when they introduce new therapies, new equipment, whatever, that they need to provide that continuing education to their employees so that they can assure that they can practice competently. I would share the comment that, first of all, the Board of Nursing receives about 2,000 complaints about Minnesota nurses each year. The vast majority of nurses in Minnesota practice safely, competently, and with quality. But the role of the Board is to deal with those complaints. Of all the individual nurses that the Board has taken action against in the past years, all of them completed their continuing education. And they did that, you know, and in spite of that, there was a practice breakdown. In some instances, it's a mistake. It's an error. In others, it's a, you know, a fault in judgment. And in others, it's a lack of knowledge for a particular situation. There is, making continuing education mandatory does not assure competence. Should continuing education change behavior and provide better quality? Certainly. We all, I think, would agree with that. But making it mandatory does not assure that individuals assure that competency.
Ms. Brecken, I just have a quick question. You know, you heard some of the concerns about doing this compact. You know, the being sued in different states, the increase in fees, et cetera, et cetera. My understanding is all the states around us participate in the compact, all five states, right? Have we seen, based on the problems that have been stated here today, have we seen a dramatic increase in those types of problems among the compact states surrounding Minnesota?
Mr. Chair, you are correct. All four of those nurses licensed by those four states bordering us have the authority to practice in Minnesota. We have not seen any increase in or you know, any change or significant difference between those nurses practicing in Minnesota and related complaints. I think it's important to recognize that Wisconsin and South Dakota are states that don't require continuing education, but we still, by law, provide that those individuals can practice in Minnesota on those states' licenses.
Thank you, Ms. Brecken. Any final comments, Representative Schumacher?
None at all.
Okay, with that, Representative or Chair Schumacher renews his motion that HF 3848, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on HHS Finance. Those in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, same sign.
No.
The motion prevails. And HF 3848, as amended, is re-referred to the Committee on HHS Finance. With that, members, the next bill on the agenda is HF 3202. Representative Schumacher moves HF 3202 be referred to the General Register. Representative Schumacher, please give a brief explanation of your bill when ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, House Bill 3202 would grant Regents Hospital an exemption to the bed license moratorium law. We're working towards this exemption from the bed moratorium law because of some of the unique services that Regents Hospital provides, including the Level 1 Trauma, the Burn Center, and its work as a safety net hospital that serves patients with unique services from all over the state, including from what I've learned even my hometown of Laverne. The hospital bed license moratorium was established by the legislature in 1984 with the intent to control growth in inpatient hospital beds. When the law passed, the number of beds allowed for each hospital was frozen, and additional beds were only permitted by gaining an exception from the legislature. In 2006, a public interest review process was added, requiring the Department of Health to provide analysis and advice to the legislature when considering exemptions. Healthcare has changed significantly since that time, and as a result of this law, more hospitals in the metro area have excess bed capacity. I've learned that Regions has a unique position in the East Metro of not only having bed licenses, of having no bed licenses that will allow them to meet the patient needs going forward. For Regions, the public interest review has not yet been completed by the Department of Health, but we have been advised that we expect to have that by the end of April as per testimony in the other body just a week or two ago. I'm committed to getting the feedback that we need to move forward, but we want to get this bill to conference committee so that the process can continue forward. That's why the bill is coming up this week. That's why it hasn't been introduced or offered earlier than this, but we're up against the deadline, so here we are. And we'll be continuing to work to make sure that we have agreement between the systems and that the department has time to weigh in and that we do this in the most appropriate manner that we can this year. With that, I have Megan Remark, the CEO of Regions, who can provide more detail about their particular offering.
Okay. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and give your testimony. If you could possibly stay within 2 minutes, it would be appreciated.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Megan Remark, and I'm the president and CEO at Regions Hospital. Thank you to Representative Schumacher for your leadership on this bill, and thank you to those of you who took the time to visit Regions and learn how we uniquely serve the East Metro. I'm here today to urge you to support House HF 3202, which provides an exception to the hospital bed moratorium for Regions Hospital to add 100 beds. With all 454 of our bed licenses in operation, we request your support to continue to serve the growing needs of our community. There's an article in your packet that shows how the population in our metropolitan area is growing. We based our analysis on the state's demographic data that indicates that all hospitals in the East Metro will need to add more beds to meet the East Metro's changing demographic needs. We're proud of our many collaborative efforts with other hospitals in our community, including providing medical respite beds at the Catholic Charities Higher Ground Shelter, the East Metro Mental Health Roundtable Initiative, and several workforce development initiatives. Regions Hospital is unique. For over 145 years, we have served as a community partner, and today we provide services that no other hospital in the East Metro provides. In this respect, Regions is the only Level 1 Trauma and Burn Center in the East Metro. This means we are always ready in the event of a mass casualty incident. We are the safety net hospital in this community, providing $17 million in uncompensated care in 2016, the second highest charity care provider in the Twin Cities, ensuring access to care for our community's most vulnerable patients. We are also proud of our commitment to mental health services, the largest provider in the East Metro. Even when we were facing a future shortage of bed licenses back in 2012, we reinvested in a new mental health building with space shelled in for 20 additional mental health beds should we get the licenses. This bed request will allow us to add those additional 20 mental health beds to our facility.
We are one of the largest teaching hospitals in the state, helping train more than 500 residents a year. And finally, we deliver high-quality care at a lower-than-average cost. In the last 5 years, Regents has seen a 25% increase in the number of patients served. Our average occupancy is 87% versus the national average of 64%. An independent analysis has showed that Regions needs additional licenses to serve our current market share of patients to meet demand from a growing and aging population and the fact that patients hospitalized today and tomorrow are sicker than in the past. We have moved patients to an outpatient setting and successfully reduced emergency room utilization through the use of primary care, urgent care, and online clinics. And the patients left going to hospitals today are the ones in the need of the most complex and specialized care. In fact, the average daily census of our inpatient care beds have risen 33% in the past 5 years. Regents respects and supports the process and statute for a public interest review by the Minnesota Department of Health to provide advice to the legislature. We submitted our request to MDH on November 20th with the expectation that the review would be complete in time for this 2018 legislative session. We have responded to their questions and we are eager for the report on the MDH public interest review. We believe the data contained in our application shows in detail why our bed license is in the public interest of our patients and our community. In conclusion, Regents is using 100% of our available beds. Turning away patients when emergency departments or inpatient units are full is on the rise for all of our East Metro hospitals. Facility planning and financing timelines for hospitals are long, and we need to start now, thus our request for your support during this legislative session. Regents Hospital bed request is in the public interest to assure that the East Metro's Level 1 Trauma and Safety Net Hospital can continue to meet the future needs of this community. I will rest for questions now, and I want to point out I do have a few colleagues in attendance today who can also answer specific questions.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Remark. At this time, instead of taking any additional testimony, we do have, I understand that an A1 amendment, that Representative Halverson wants to offer an A1 amendment. Representative Halverson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I'd like to move the A1 amendment, please.
Representative Halverson moved the A1 amendment. Do you want to give a brief explanation of the amendment?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is an amendment that deals with the public interest review. I think that we've acknowledged that we don't have all the information currently that we were expecting when we heard this proposal, and because we're waiting for more information from the Department of Health. Because the hospital introduced their proposal in late November, we don't have what we need. And so what I would like to do is add a provision in the public interest review with some expectations around dates. So if this happens again, we have, as a legislature, all the information we need when we're meeting in committee to discuss this, because I think that the hospital moratorium laws is really important in Minnesota, making sure that we maintain balance in the care that we're giving our patients. So this would just say that if a hospital is seeking an exemption, they would have to have their plan submitted by August 1st of the calendar year prior to when we would consider it by the legislature, and that the Department of Health would give them adequate notice of no more than 30 days after the initial submission if they needed more information. So just to ensure that we get everything we need as legislators.
Chair Schumacher, thoughts on the A1 amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Halverson, and I will just note that this is my first bed moratorium bill, and I had a full head of hair before I introduced it, so if we can do things to improve the process overall that still keeps the legislature making the final decision, but make sure that we have the public input that we need and does it in a speedier, more timely process, I want to encourage that, and so I'd ask members to support the A1 amendment.
Okay, any discussion, Representative Albright, on the amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and the question goes to the author of the amendment. I'm just wondering if this is prospectively. I don't see an effective date, and I'm just wondering if she'd be able to clarify when this would take effect, if there's a separate effective date for the amendment, or if it would follow along with the date of enactment clause in the bill itself.
Representative Halverson.
Mr. Chair, I assume that because we're amending the bill that it would follow the date of enactment clause, but staff can certainly clarify.
Ms. Clarbus?
Mr. Chair and members, the effective date for this section would be August 1st.
Okay.
Of what year?
Representative, what year, Ms.?
August 1st, 2018.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Oh, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just, Representative Halverson, I probably should have asked you this before, but I assume that the Department of Health thinks that these timelines are workable.
Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Liebling, I drafted this rather quickly, so I didn't get a chance to talk to the department, but this amendment also went on in a bill in the other body as well. So this would make us consistent with what we're hearing from the other body.
And I do believe this has another stop, right?
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I saw heads nodding in the audience. I don't know if that means that, yes, it is. But, yes, I'm getting the confirmation from the Department of Health that, yes, they do think that this is workable. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions on the A1 amendment? Seeing none, I'll call for the vote. All those in favor, say aye.
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 All those opposed, same sign. The A1 amendment passes and is adopted. To Chair Schumacher, do you have other testifiers on the bill?
I do not.
Anyone in the audience would like to testify for or against the bill?
Yes.
Okay. Please come forward and introduce yourself. And we're a very tight timeline. If you could keep your comments to about 2 minutes or less. Please introduce yourself.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good morning. I'm Ann Thompson, speaking on behalf of the Sisters of St. Joseph of Carondelet in St. Paul, or as we're often referred to, CSJs. I also want to introduce to you Sister Suzanne Herder, a member of our leadership team. Okay. In reference to House File 3202, to be clear, the CSJs have nothing against regions being successful in growing their business. What we do have concerns about is a lack of understanding about the ramifications of this decision. Very likely, the addition of 100 beds at regions could end up closing St. Joseph's Hospital. Is this in the best interest of the people of St. Paul? The sisters have been in St. Paul since 1851. In 1853, the city of St. Paul experienced a cholera epidemic. The sisters did what they were founded to do many hundreds of years ago, respond to the needs of the times. The students at St. Joseph's Academy moved out of the log cabin chapel that St. Paul took its name from, and the cholera patients moved in. St. Joseph's Hospital was born. When a ministry the sisters establish gets healthy enough, the sisters move on to other things and let the organization carry on the sisters' mission. That's how it was with St. Joe's Hospital, St. Catherine University, the Academy of Holy Angels, Durham Hall High School, now Creighton Durham Hall High School, and so many more. Today, the sisters are not involved with the day-to-day operations of the hospital, but we do have a group that informs the hospital's mission. So we appreciated when we recently were informed that the hospital would create 105 beds to address a currently unmet need in our community, mental health and chemical dependency. Just yesterday, more than one sister specifically mentioned their concern for people suffering from meth and opioid addiction. Think about it. Do you know anyone struggling to make it on this sometimes excruciatingly challenging planet we call Earth? From the sister's perspective, this was a very good thing. So, should you care about St. Joe's? We believe you care about those in need in St. Paul and the Twin Cities and Minnesota. We understand the Department of Health is working on a report to assess the impact of Region's request. That's a great idea. We can't help but wonder if it would be helpful to at least peek at that report before deciding to grant this exemption to the building moratorium. Sure, it's exciting to see growth in St. Paul. We all love that. But maybe instead of a plan that puts the growth of one organization above the best interests of this entire community, we could recommend at least considering collaboration. At a minimum, we ask you to consider waiting on a decision until the Department of Health's report can give you what you need to create wise legislation that will serve the best and highest interests of our entire beloved St. Paul community. On behalf of the sisters, and on behalf of all those who won't have a chance to weigh in on this issue, nor appreciate its long-term implications, we thank you for listening.
Thank you for your testimony, Sister Thompson. Is there anyone else that wants to testify on the bill? With that, we have questions for the testifier. Representative McDonald.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just if you would take back to St. Joseph of Crondeley, hello from one of their favorite nephews. My father has, out of the six sisters, he had four sisters, the McDonald nuns, Sister Rita, Sister Jane, Sister Bridget, and Sister Kate, which I'm sure you all know.
Yes, very well.
Doing very well. Two of them still live at St. Joe's. So say hello to them for me and let them know I will not do anything that would make them upset, usually. I've been down this Capitol many times.
No elaboration. So, Representative Sandstead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is both to the author and the testifier. So, if I understand it correctly, should this moratorium be lifted, then additional beds could be built for Regions. Is there any specification on what type of beds those would be?
Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Sandstead. There's nothing in particular at this point about the types of beds that would be licensed for that. We do know that the Department of Health would have the ability to roll out those beds on an as-needed basis in the request if the moratorium is lifted.
I see Ms. Cox might be able to help on this.
I'm going to have that.
Ms. Remack?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if I understand the question, it's what is the use of the beds? What will our beds be used for? We have outlined in our bed application that we are requesting 100 beds, 20 for mental health, 20 for OB-GYN for our birth center, and 60 for medicine, surgery, and ICUs.
Representative Sandstead.
Thank you. I appreciate the clarification. To hear testimony that the possible expansion could potentially take away what I see could be 105 mental health beds should St. Joe have to close down. I have a concern about that because of the shortage of mental health facilities and beds that we have in the state of Minnesota. So I have to weigh that very carefully. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and quickly to the author or perhaps somebody from the department. We heard testimony from the CSJs, and just an editorial, Emma Katie, so thanks for caring for us all those years, sisters. We heard testimony that they could see a potential closure of a hospital. Is part of the analysis that we're going to hear impacts on other hospitals or bed capacity in surrounding communities? I'm not sure exactly how far the public interest analysis goes.
Ms. Renmark, do you want to respond to that question?
So I guess I thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to just express the fact that we do not believe there's a correlation between our bed request and a potential closure of a hospital in St. Paul. We believe that our analysis will, and it has demonstrated, that there is a need for increasing beds across the East Metro region, not just Regents Hospital, and Regents Hospital is the only one without the ability to grow. So our other two hospitals in the downtown area do have the opportunity to expand, and we would welcome that expansion both in mental health and in medicine and surgical specialties. I would also add that our request is really focused on the unique needs of Regents Hospital as the level one and safety net hospital, providing a disproportionate share of care for uncompensated patients. And without these beds, that reduces our ability to provide the full support of our mission, which also includes being the mass casualty hospital for our region.
With that, members, our time is up.
Mr. Chairman, if we could just get to that one point. I think the answer is yes, so I'd like to get through that from the department since they're here so we can conclude with that.
Okay, Mr. Chair. The department, please introduce yourself and give your testimony.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Stefan Gildemeis. I direct the Health Economics Program in the Department of Health, and it's our team that's conducting the public interest review right now on the region's proposal. Yes, the answer is we are looking at the impact of other facilities, financial and otherwise.
Thank you.
With that, we'll have to lay the bill over. Our time is up, and we have Representative Liebling. You'll be the first with questions when we come back. We will recess until the call of the chair at approximately 6:30 this evening. Thank you, member.
And I remember it going about a fountain, but I didn't want to do it.